Okay, so I came here prepared to talk about performance tuning in POSIX, because that's what I've been doing for a long time, is performance tuning POSIX. But I want to make it quite clear that if you like something else about POSIX, or you think I know something about something else that has nothing to do with POSIX, whatever, I'm flexible. The slides are not overly detailed, they're just sort of an outline of things I might want to talk about. If you would like to take me in a completely different direction, not a problem, we'll go in a completely different direction. I don't know how many of you noticed, there's a ringer in the room. but anyway, maybe he'll answer some questions too if you're interested. I like this quote of John Mash. He used to post it to sort of Comp.Arch and various other places in the 80s, basically describing the performance characteristics of supercomputers. Indeed, money can buy you lots of bandwidth. You can put in lots of parallel memory banks, lots of CPUs, and so on. But the speed of light isn't going to change anytime soon. And there are certain fundamental things that if you want to design a high-throughput system that you have to work with. And pretty much there's only one trick in the book, is that you can amortize latency, which is inevitable, through concurrency. If you want to get more done, and latency is inevitable, and so there's only so much you can do per thread of activity, you're on lots of them. If memory is your bottleneck in a supercomputer, then what you do is you try and get as much done with whatever little memory you've retrieved into your cache, and in the meantime, you have multiple outstanding memory fetches. The longer your memory fetch pipeline, so long as it's a reasonably good predictor of what memory you'll need, the more likely a supercomputer is to deliver decent performance. Yes, VT.
Actually, this is a thing that people also suggest for using all those videos cooling or multiple machines. So you have one cool that actually executes things and the other cool.
Right. So indeed, a good memory predictor, pumping the cache full of data, is what you need for a high-performance system. These concepts are not too far into an MTA, and we'll see to what extent they're applicable. I started typing the talk. The date you'll notice has a Cyrillic month. It's an accident, but I left it that way. I sometimes do search for Russian things, and so I have a Russian keyboard thing in my Mac, and as I was typing the date, somehow got activated. So it's the 4th of Fevral, 2008. Actually, 9, isn't it? But oh well. life goes on. So what is this talk about? Well, anything POSIX you want to ask. By the way, this is an opportunity for, is anybody interested in things dramatically different from performance that maybe we'll spend additional time on, or is that a sufficiently interesting topic for today? Any other contributions? Anybody? Well, I'll ask again later. Yes.
Just maybe, serving for other domains,
Hosting lots of domains with PostFix.
Yeah, hosting lots of domains.
Okay, I'll try and talk about that a little bit. This is not a sort of configuration recipe talk. I'm not very good at configuration recipes because I get lost in the weeds. I see so many different things to tune and so on. But getting you just the high-level stuff that is what you need is not. I'm not necessarily the best one to do that, but I'll try and cover that towards the end if there's time. We'll talk about how MTAs perform, how POSIX was designed to perform as a good MTA should perform. We'll look at a little bit of what you do if you're having problems, or you want to understand whether your performance is approximately as it should be, or whether you're missing out on a lot of opportunity to do better. And then look at a few tricks that have become possible with recent releases of POSIX that nobody's using yet. Not the releases, the tricks. And we'll see where that takes us. So what are the basic ideas of performance in a sort of parallel multitasking system? The most important thing is concurrency. How many independent units of work are you doing at the same time? Throughput is the total amount of work you're doing. And latency is how long it takes you to do any particular thread. So if you have a building with elevators that are moving people around, and there are, let's say, you know, 5 or 6 elevator banks, and everybody's going from the ground floor to, you know, in the morning to whatever middle floors there are in the building, it takes a certain amount of time for the elevator to, you know, drop all the people off and come back to the ground floor and pick up the next block. And that's the sort of fundamental latency of an elevator. Of course, the latency of elevators is stochastic and a little hard to predict. The same is not actually too dramatically different for email either. But in any case, you have some sort of under normal conditions, you have a sense of what the average latency of the elevator is. And then, of course, somebody has a heart attack in the elevator, and the elevator gets congested, and something else happens, then latency can get different. But under normal conditions, you know, it takes however long it takes. And if you have a building with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people coming in, the former World Trade Center or something, with lots of floors, then you could figure out how many people you could bring to the top of the building per minute. You estimate your rush hour load of people coming in at 8 in the morning, and you know how many elevator banks you need to build, or how wide you need to make the cars so that each car can take 50 people all at once, and so on. Although if you take 50 people all at once and they're all getting up at different stops, naturally your latency will go up a bit. So you don't necessarily win. But in any case, there's a fundamental equation that lets you take a quantitative approach to performance tuning. That's, you know, you kind of wing it. You can't actually do realistic models of performance of systems on anything as complex as an MTA or even as simple as a set of elevators in a building, if you believe that's simple. Well, I think there are lots of research papers showing that it's not so simple. But you can kind of estimate it with, okay, what's my concurrency? How many elevators do I have? What's my latency? How long does it take each one to make a round trip from the ground floor, you know, up and down again? That's my latency. My throughput, which is the number of elevator rides, is concurrency over latency, so that's a number of rides per unit time. Of course, in an elevator, you might also be interested in how many people there are in an elevator. In an MTA, you might care about how many recipients there are in a message on average, if you're trying to measure throughput in terms of recipients delivered rather than messages delivered. You know, what perspective changes from time to time. In any system that's a queuing system that takes on workload, right, workload arrives outside of the system's control. People storm into the lobby and there they are. In any such system, things go well so long as the inflow rate is below the peak output rate of the system. You know, everything looks peachy. You know, sort of people pile in, and you don't notice anything different until a critical point arrives when the input rate exactly matches the output rate. And then, very sharply, things go to hell in a basket because you cannot go any faster. Your output is saturated, and the input keeps coming and coming. There are more and more people in your lobby, and there's nothing you can do. Your elevators don't go any faster. You're screwed. Congestive collapse. The people are all angry. There's a mob down in the lobby. All the elevators aren't working, and they're not happy. So it's a little hard to see the crunch coming in a system, in a queuing system that takes on a workload, because up until the moment when you fail, you're often doing quite nicely. It's that transition from doing quite nicely to failing that's very sudden and important to keep an eye out for. But it's not the fault of any of the software or any of the designs. It's just the nature of things. When you have a decoupled input and output and something trying to shovel from one side to the other, once that rate is exceeded, you lose. Any such system exhibits congestive collapse. The congestive collapse, at least in an MTA, can happen in a number of ways. You can saturate your output, so that just means you simply can't go fast enough to get stuff out. You can saturate your input. In terms of this building analogy, maybe the doors to the lobby aren't wide enough. People aren't even getting into the building, right? You know, they're trying to get through the turnstile, and you know there's only so much capacity there. And you know, you might have lots of output capacity, ready and waiting elevators sitting there empty, but nobody can get into the building because there's a long line outside, because the doors are too narrow, or there's too few of them, or whatever. So, oops, that's not supposed to happen.
Yes. Quick question. I hope it's not tangential anyway, but how does that interplay with anti-spam stuff? I mean, I assume your anti-spam stuff is totally separate from your MTAs.
What do you mean totally separate from my MTAs? I have, in my case, because I run a pretty large shop with money, at least for the moment with money, or somebody else's money, the story is that we actually have multiple layers of anti-spam. The first layer is this traffic shaping device that's traffic shapes based on observed reputation. So systems that send you lots of junk progressively get a lot less bandwidth and a lot smaller share of the connections, and a lot lower probability that they'll be able to reconnect after they've already been connected, and all kinds of nasty things get done to them, increasingly as the reputation gets worse. But if their reputation is neutral to good, they see a pretty responsive MTA. So the first few messages come in unimpeded, even if we've never seen them before. The moment they establish any sort of bad reputation, they start seeing a haze modem, you know, worth of bandwidth in their direction. And life isn't so good for them. And so that thing works fairly well. It cuts down to about 80% or so of the spam right there, because spammers aren't able to connect nearly as well as they would otherwise. The next layer is just built in with postfix. You know, we're doing standard RBLs and access lists and various, you know, naive checks. But most of the work is really zen.spamhouse.org. In this day and age, there's really only one RBL, and then there's all the others. And that one is just at least an order, you know, a factor of 10 more hits than any of the other lists, and far fewer false positives than most of the other lists. So by the time you've deployed Zen, it's hardly worth bothering with anything else. Some people have some good luck with SpamCop. And rumor has it that even historically they've told you, do not use SpamCop to block. You know, lately people are saying, well, it works pretty well, not so bad. Maybe they've gotten a lot better at not being too aggressive. And they do have early intelligence, so maybe they respond a little bit faster than SpamHouse. But the beautiful thing about SpamHouse is that you've got three things going on in there. You've got the traditional SBL, you know, lots and lots of intelligence and research work, finding the spammers and networks they properly own, and listing them, and the SBL is pretty stable and old. But it's not dramatically effective. Spammers don't send from their own networks anymore. Then you've got the CBL, which is it's really the XBL, but it's mostly CBL. And that's traffic from compromised nodes that are actually observed to emit viral-generated traffic. And that stuff gets listed and delisted automatically and pretty aggressively. And that contributes for a good chunk of the effectiveness of SpamHouse. But the most important part of the SpamHouse list, the part that makes the Zen part, is the PBL, the policy blacklist. That currently lists about 480 million IP addresses. And that's a sizable chunk of the total IP address space of the 32-bit internet. So a vast number of nodes simply will not be able to talk to you and transmit any mail once you deploy the PBL. It's proactive defense. You don't know whether they're spamming you or not. In practice, they're never sending you any real mail. That's why they're on the PBL. They're consumer nodes, cable modems all over the place, whatever. If they want to talk to you, they should talk to their ISP first. And too bad for all the Soho people trying to run Linux at home. Sorry, guys. You don't get to send mail directly to people who employ the PBL. But that well has been poisoned, so you're out of luck. And so that's postfix. And only behind that do we have any sort of CPU-intensive content analyzers. And they catch only 5% of the mail. So we're delivering, by that point, after the traffic shaper and spam house, a 95% clean mail stream.
My question, I hate getting so right. vague, but in terms of the effect of if this anti-spam stuff is all happening way outside.
Well, not all.
Calculating a lot of, or just in terms of
right.
the gateway stuff, and Just in terms of the impact on latency and so on. So it's really
negligible. Right. The main thing that the traffic shaping does for us is that it reduces the connection concurrency demand by telling a lot of those nasty connections from spammers, TCP reset, go away. So if you can afford that kit, or if you're smart enough and you can build it, you know, into your own sort of firewall device that's able to, you know, maintain about a 2 to 3 million node sort of blacklist of nodes that have spammed you in the past at various reputation levels and various tuning for the bandwidth they get and the connection concurrency they get and the required minimum stay away times and all the features of the commercial thing we're using. And if you need that sort of stuff, by all means, deploy it. It's very important for us. It cut down the volume of content analysis we have to do by about a factor of 7 or so. So we went from quarantining about 400,000 messages a day to quarantining about 80,000 messages a day. Or actually, no, sorry, 120. Sorry, it wasn't factor of 7. Once we had the PBL also, we got another factor of 2 or so reduction. And so whereas in 2006, I think, or 2007, right, in October or so, we were quarantining 400,000 a day, now we're quarantining 45,000 a day. And not because the spammers are trying to send us less, but simply because we're doing a lot more at the edge before we have to look at the content. Yes?
What's your total load of spam?
Total spam, we deliver about 2 million real messages a day. And quarantine, as I was saying, about 50,000.
And drop at the connection level?
We drop about 80% of connections, 80-90% of connections, just with the TCP reset stuff at the edge. And then there's SBL dropping another, you know, 80% or so of connections with 5XX go away. So there's a lot of filtering. Three layers seems to do pretty well at the moment. Yes?
The RDL layer, that's done by Postfix or done by SFB?
It's done by a build. RDL support is built into Postfix, check RDL client, pretty standard. You can read all about it in various guides. But Postfix.
People are aware, Postfix does that. It's just a question of.
Not by default. You have to enable that stuff.
Well, right? Yeah. No, but I mean, it's all in the main, right? Yeah, it's all in there. But I mean, I guess. I don't mean to jump in, Mark, but part of it is like, I wouldn't want to do that on my SMTP box. I would want that, especially because Morgan Stanley is.
What do you mean by your SMTP box? Any box doing it somewhere is an SMTP box. So the question is, which one?
Your main Postfix at MorganStanley.com boxes.
Well, we
have processing mail.
The edge gateways are doing exactly this.
Right.
They're the MX host for MorganStanley.com. They're doing this RDL stuff. That's what they're doing. They're doing it behind the traffic shaper, which is doing the TCP resets. And so in combination between the traffic shaper, which learns the history of nodes that persist, and the PBL, which says no to nodes that have no business coming to you in the first place, that are compromised at random, the better the PBL gets, the harder it is for a spammer send any garbage our way. The PBL, when I first adopted it, I think it was the beginning of 2007 or so, the PBL originally had about 180 million nodes. Now it has 480 million nodes. So it's grown a lot and continues to grow. The more, you know, non-MTA blocks are discovered and contributed to Spam House as part of the PBL, the harder it is for spammers who take over botnet nodes to send any mail, and that's good. So PBL is effective. Traffic shaping is effective. Not everybody needs traffic shaping. You know, if your load is light enough, you'll get by without it. You'll have to throw a little bit more CPU at quarantining mail, but that's okay if your load's light enough. You probably have that CPU. I run only 6 boxes to take 2 million messages a day input. If you're only doing 100,000 messages a day, you could probably in one box do everything I'm doing without the traffic shaper. It's just that you'll have to do more of it based on CPU rather than this network thing, which is expensive, unfortunately. Soundhouse costs us about $10,000 a year in subscription for the feed. The boxes cost us about a factor of 10 more. But, you know, Soundhouse is very cheap by comparison. But the boxes, so the very limited thing, are worth it. More on spam for a moment, or should we move on?
Move on.
Okay. So we were going to talk about performance. Congestive collapse. So your input can get into a straitjacket. There was actually exactly that situation happening about a year ago when Vitzi wrote the stress readme.html file for Postfix. All of a sudden, a whole bunch of malware decided to connect to you and stay connected after you said no. And that was reasonably unpleasant. And lots of people started seeing their TAs totally saturated because there were all these bozos standing at the doors blocking everybody else getting in. And so you had to get aggressive with people you said no to. And there's all this stress adaptive behavior that allows you to notice that, gee, all my processes are tied up. I'm going to start reducing the company idle timers. I'm going to be more aggressive about disconnecting the moment I say no, all kinds of nasty stuff. So that's all available. You can read the stress_readme.html file. I'll show you the URL for that in a minute. The symptoms of this, by the way, are that you try to connect to your system on port 25, and it takes a bloody long time to even get connection established. Or you get connection established, and you're sitting there in the TCP backlog queue for all the kernel hackers, you know about that thing, and you're waiting for a process to get around to accepting your connection. And the accepts don't happen very soon because all the processes are busy. Postfix is a concurrency-limited system. That really means that under sufficient load, instead of your system running out of memory and crashing, your system keeps on working about as well as it can, but the outside basically is unable to impose any more load on it than you can before it runs out of memory and runs out of process slots and so on. You can tune the number of process slots that are available in Postfix. Recent releases on BSD, let's say, that use KQ, easily scale beyond 1,000 processes in a box, provided you have the RAM, and provided most of those processes are idle, which they tend to be when they're waiting for spammers to get around to doing whatever it is that they're doing, mostly just trying to DOS you. So it might not even be unreasonable if your RAM is adequate to declare your process limit for the SMTP server in main.cf, master.cf, to be 10,000 processes if you want. Vitzi's not too happy about that idea. But 1,000 is okay, 2,000 may be okay, 10,000, you need a pretty sizable, beefy box, and make sure that the kernel really scales to that process count. If you config switch rapidly enough, if your kernel can do it, you've got enough cores, all of that kind of heavy stuff, go for it. Clearly, probably not on your 3-year-old PC, but a reasonably modern, 8-way server with all that kind of stuff, you might be able to scale it up to a large number of connections. Beyond that, you might go to load balancers. Load balancers aren't magic. They have memory limitations, too. Although they don't dedicate as much memory per connection as a full process, so they might be able to scale to a few million connections in various cases. But that also costs you money in terms of the design of the load balancer. Anyway, so input can be saturated. The last thing, and you'll probably never see with Postfix, is that the switch that moves data from the input to the output can be saturated. In a router, it would be the logic that takes a packet in. Sure, your input is coming in, and you're able to take it in, and it's below wire rates, and you're happy. But there's somewhere a CPU in the router that says, okay, this packet came in, which interface am I going to send it out on? That CPU has to keep up with the load. Yes?
The Postfix is actually modeled after a router, but it's a very classical router. So the router doesn't have a class path.
Right. Right. So it is possible in theory to saturate the switch. So your output capacity is fine, and your input capacity is fine, but the switch can't take decisions fast enough. I've done some lab measurements, at least with Postfix running on RAM disk, which is not exactly fair, but it measures the limiting factor of the switch itself and the CPU that's involved in there, rather than the I.O. cost of doing what the queue manager is doing. And when you're on the queue manager on RAM disk, even on a dual-core Opteron, it scales to about 3,000 messages a second easily. And then the queue manager tends to run out of them right around there. But that's not a realistic load for anybody that I know of. So the queue manager, at least CPU-wise, in terms of its workload, is not a bottleneck. It can be a problem if your queue manager is doing high-latency table lookups. The queue manager was fixed between 1.0 and POSIX 2.0 to not do any table lookups directly. All the tables disappear from the queue manager. The queue manager is not doing any LDAP or MySQL or any of that nonsense. But the queue manager is talking to the trivial rewrite daemon, asking it, what route do I take for this address? What route do I take for this address? And so on. The queue manager is just the scheduler. The thing that actually makes the routing decisions is the trivial rewrite daemon. And if you tie that thing to LDAP and your LDAP server is slow, your switch could collapse. In practice, most of the time, your switch is not going to be slow. Your LDAP performs reasonably well, properly tuned, and maybe it's okay. But there's sort of a caveat there that, you know, warranties off if you're potentially using a high-latency LDAP server half a continent away that's, you know, overloaded by all those exchange users doing all their address completion and so on, then you're not going to be a happy PostFix user because your queue manager will stall. The queue manager depends on rapid and timely responses for where do I send this address. Alright, so the switch can get saturated. Okay, so I've actually, this is stolen from BT, copyright violation. It is very old. It's not even completely accurate, but I didn't have time. But it's somewhat accurate. So POSIX input. So we said, you know, input can get saturated. The only input that really matters these days is the SMTP server there, although we can talk briefly about pickup. Is there anybody who's interested in high-performance local mail submission from the sendmail command? Oh, wow. Okay, there is such a person. PostFix is not really designed to take huge volumes of mail submitted via the sendmail command. That mail is handled by a single-threaded pickup process. So there is very little opportunity for parallelism, for that concurrency to amortize your latency. So the pickup daemon is picking up messages the sendmail submits one at a time, sending them into the queue. A commit happens, you know, disk IO flush, you know, take the next message, do that thing again. And so you'll find at some point you hit an IO bottleneck. And that point happens pretty rapidly. It's whatever rate one cleanup server can do its commit. So it's the disk access latency. If you have, you know, a real physical disk doing this, maybe you'll get 30 messages a second into pickup. And then you kind of die, you know, obviously you have battery backup, you know, accelerated, you know, modern hardware. So if you care about very high performance local pickup, you need that RAM disk or non-volatile RAM disk or whatever. Otherwise, switch to SMTP. What pickup can do rapidly is process messages with a lot of recipients. So mailing list messages, where it's one message and it has 300,000 recipients on it, not a problem. But 300,000 messages to one recipient, not too good a design to try and shove that into pickup. I won't be talking about much more about pickup, although one can say a lot more about it, but we'll see, maybe later. So there's pickup mail drop stuff. The design is very tied around the fact that it should be possible to submit mail even when the mail system is down. Right? So there's this asynchronous drop-in in the file system. PostFix may not have started yet, it may have crashed, whatever. You're not losing local mail from cron jobs and so on, telling you how hosed your system are, just because it happens to be hosed right now. When it comes back up, you'll find out all the ways in which it was hosed. And some of them you may care to know about so that you can fix it for next time. So the SMTP server. The SMTP server talks to the internet. This picture shows in blue, this is Vince's picture, all the various table sources that various things consult. Processes are in oval shapes, and queues are in square boxes, yellow square boxes. So the SMTP server over here consults RPLs over the internet. In my case, because I need reliability and low latency, one of the main things that can slow you down when you're receiving mail over the internet is the latency of DNS lookups and the latency of RPL lookups, which are still DNS, but the DNS for a different cause. And so if you want a high-performance acoustic server, you really want those DNS lookups to be as fast as possible. We don't ask SpamHouse for the SpamHouse data. We rsync it and pay for the privilege to rsync it, and the data is always local. So at least the RBL results are milliseconds away. The DNS lookups for resolving the reverse IP address to the client are not milliseconds away, and under stress, you can look at that stress README document later, you can optionally turn that off. If nothing else works, reduce the amount of time it takes to resolve an incoming connection to an IP address, and notice suddenly how connections are processed a lot faster, and the demand for connection concurrency may drop, and you may be able to get more people in the door, and avoid that input saturation. Beyond that, the SMTP server talks to the cleanup daemon in real time before the client has hung up. So at the time which the client says dot, most of the I/O penalty happens because the cleanup server has to commit every last bit to disk. Because unlike lots of other MTAs that pretend to give you high performance by not bothering to commit the data to disk before the client goes away, POSIX actually does a transaction, commits the data to stable storage. If the OS doesn't lie, some OSs lie, but if the OS doesn't lie, the data will still be there even if you yank the power cord.
Your hard disk doesn't lie.
Right, if your hard disk doesn't lie. Right, a hard disk is supposed to atomically write sectors and not half write a sector and all kinds of stuff like that. There's all kinds of assumptions about what the OS does and what the hard disk does that ought to be true. We want them to be true, whether they're true or not, a matter of experience. So this cleanup server, and the cleanup server is I/O bound. Unless an idiot puts in body checks rules, the wazoo, security sage anybody, then your cleanup server can be CPU starved. Don't do that to your cleanup server. Your body checks and the header checks may be tens of 20 different things, and that's about it. Just the most critical obvious stuff that was bothering you over the last 2 weeks, and then once the particular pattern that you're pushing away has stopped happening, you delete it as quickly as possible. Don't keep lots of garbage around in your header and body checks. So cleanup should be fast, but it's I/O bound. So a classical POSIX system is I/O bound, and at some point you will find that you will not be able to handle any more mail because your disk is saturated. However, that was a long time ago. Before we had to spend oodles and oodles and oodles of CPU with content filters. Some people do pre-queue filters, we'll get to that in a minute. Some people do post-queue filters, and we'll talk about what the performance implications of both are. In any case, the cleanup daemon moves everything into the incoming queue, and at that point, it's on the switch's input queue. The queue manager then has to pick it up from the incoming queue and decide what to do with it. So the input stage's job is over when the mail hits the incoming queue. If your switch isn't keeping up, can anybody predict what will happen if the queue manager for some reason is saturated, but your input is going nicely? The incoming queue will grow. So if you see an MTA with an empty active and output queue, and an incoming queue with 100,000 messages in it, guess what? In that MTA, for some reason, the queue manager is just not keeping up. But the moment the queue managers make the decision how to route it, that output stage is gung-ho, ready to go, delivers the message, drains it right away. So the active queue is empty, essentially, because the output stage is way faster than the queue manager. So if you see an imbalance where you've got a huge pile of mail in the incoming queue and nothing else happening in the rest of the system, something's preventing the queue manager from making progress. Now, that something doesn't have to be the queue manager itself being slow. There are all kinds of issues with timestamps and NFS servers, and I don't want to get into all of that. But there can be reasons why the queue manager might think that it doesn't need to do the work yet. Maybe it should do the work later. Those are generally misconfigurations of your system of one form or another. But they can happen. You have to determine whether the queue manager is just working too hard or whether it's sitting around waiting for work to do and for some reason doesn't believe that any of the work that's piled up in the incoming queue is already to be processed yet. But one or the other can happen. Yes?
So one of the good things of having a system that is a couple years old is it's not just the software that was implemented to mail delivery. It's also a whole stack of workarounds for all the stuff that you're into as people deploy it. And so one of Joseph Sommer is a kind believer when the clock jumps.
Right.
Well, I don't think so, because part of Joseph has time to do it, so it schedules things to go the same. And there is something in there that actually cleans your clock.
Yes, it smooths the jump down into steps.
So if the clock jumps back, it'll just slow down its idea of the clock. And it schedules still properly.
There's some scary code in there. So some of it I haven't read in any detail yet. No, the real world indeed is a little scary, scary place. But the good news is that the algorithms are all there. And it's impressive, thank you, Mitzi, how much care and detail went into making sure that things behave as they ought to behave, not only when everything behaves as it's documented, but also when things behave as they really do. There's all kinds of defensive code in there to deal with many generations of screw-ups observed in quite a large range of platforms. So in any case, that's the input stage. There's also a QMQP server, which almost nobody uses except for easy MLM users, maybe still here and there.
Bugtrack.
So there's a QMQP server, which is compatible with the QMail submission service. That's about it. Mail can come in locally for send mail, SMTP, or QMQP. There's no LMTP server, although it'd be relatively easy to implement, but there hasn't been any demand.
It actually exists, but I didn't include it.
Right. Hypothetically, someday, if anybody cares enough, it would be possible to add an LMTP server. It would be pretty similar to the SMTP server, but not necessary at the moment. Okay. So I've talked through most of these things. The concurrency limit is the process limit of your SMTP server. Postfix ships in 2.0, I think, with a default process limit of 100. It used to be 50 in the 1.0 release. In 2.0 release, it got bumped to 100. Even 100 is a little light these days. Maybe at some point it should jump to 200. I don't know. But just today, there was somebody on the list who, you know, raised the purchase limit to 200 and was a lot happier as a result. But on the other hand, if you still support, and VC still doesn't, it has a few users running on 386 hardware and some Spark Station 1s and all that kind of stuff, then the 100 purchases might be too much. You know, those machines with only 2 megs of RAM or something, I'm not going to be too happy if, you know, Postfix 2.6 comes out and wants to run 1,000 purchases by default. Huh?
138 megabytes.
Right, so anyway, 1 meg, I'm kidding. I still remember the Sun 350. I don't know how many of you remember the Sun 350, but there was a 1 megahertz, 1 meg machine, well, 4 megahertz, 4 mega machine, but in any case, and 1 megapixel. But it was kind of the 3M machine, megapixel, megahertz, megabyte. Anyway, yes.
What are the disadvantages of disabling reverse DNS?
The disadvantages of disabling reverse DNS is that your logs don't contain any hostnames. When you look at your logs years later and you ask yourself, well, you know, who the hell was connecting to me? All you have is IP addresses, and they've changed hands so many times since that it's really hard to do any forensics. However, otherwise, the reverse client name is not really significant. You shouldn't be using it for anything too important in terms of allowing access, because actually allowing access on reverse client names is fragile. Because when you get a negative answer from DNS that's a temporary failure, what are you supposed to do now? So you don't know whether the client is permitted or not. What do you do? The only correct thing to do at that point is essentially to start deferring always where you would otherwise reject for every client whose name you cannot resolve. But then all these clients who are real MTAs perhaps will start coming back at you and sending you the same mail over and over again simply because you cannot resolve their IP address properly. And this is not really a good thing. So on the whole, you're not going to make any decisions, policy decisions, based on a reverse client name, because it's not reliably available. So it's only useful as a forensic thing, and it's good to have that data in your logs. But if you turn it off, okay, so you only have IP addresses, it's not the end of the world. Right? And your received headers only contain IP addresses. Unknown. Okay, so mostly nobody cares. But you might a year or two later if you keep your logs that long and you want to understand what was going on with that. But it's under stress, it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do to say, okay, I've got too much work, I'm not doing reverse DNS lookups. No problem. So concurrency equals the process limit. Process limit, as I said, defaults to 200. I'm using about 900 at the moment. Yes?
No.
Oh, sorry, the default is 100, yes. And I'm using 900 at the moment on my servers and getting away with it quite nicely. We've got six of them. So I've got a pool of 3,600 SMTP connections that are managed by the throttling appliance.
That's the same as connection limit?
Yep.
In essence, well, it's a process. Every process terminates one connection.
Okay.
If you're counting processes in PS, you'll get a false picture. Because postfix daemons linger to do more work. Postfix amortizes fork exec overhead by having daemons reuse themselves. And so you'll say, gee, I've got 100 SMTP servers running. I must be over the limit. I need to add more. No, they're just sitting around waiting for work. It's okay to have 100 SMTP servers running. The question is how many connections are actually established. And so you really want to measure your connection concurrency, not your process count. Although these days, in 2.4 or 2.5 and later, once all the processes really are in use, you'll actually be able to see that fact in PS because the process will start waking up with -o stress equals yes in their command line. So when you start seeing that kind of nonsense, then you'll know that they've all recently been saturated and busy, and the master daemon had to notice the fact that every single process was occupied and started forking them off with, I'm under stress. And that's when they would start using configuration settings that are appropriate for a stressed environment. What are the sources of latency? The latency is just whatever the client is doing. If the client decides to send you mail slowly, then you get high latency. In the case of my own traffic shaping appliance, if it tells the client TCP reset go away, that's great. If it tells the client, okay, you can come in, but I'm giving you a Hayes modem worth of bandwidth, that costs me. Because now he's sending me a megabyte's worth of mail at 5 bits a second or something, and I'm tying up SMTP processes. So I don't want to be doing too much of that. And certainly don't want to set the bandwidth limits per spammer too aggressively. But if I'm giving them that kind of bandwidth, it really would be much better for me and for them to reset the connection. Targeting hurts you more than it hurts them. They've got a lot more resources than you do. Yes?
What about just sending a packet back to them every 2 seconds? That kind of tying up of their connection?
Well, there are... Let's see. So the problem with postfix, or the problem, whatever, a feature of postfix is that each connection occupies a server process. There isn't a single process which has got a large pool of open file descriptors cheaply multiplexing between them, although there is this file descriptor passing protocol, and a few adventurous souls have front ends for postfix that accept connections, rate their reputation, target the ones that they want to target, and only hand off connections to the real postfix SMTP server that they deem are appropriate to hand off. And in that case, you can scale and afford to target. That protocol is kind of sort of documented. It's fairly advanced. But it's basically file descriptor passing to the SMTP server. You run a pass server. And I'm not going to go into the details. You can do some research on the Postfix website. You might even have to read some code for examples. Maybe contact Michael Tokarev and find out how he's doing it. Yes?
So how do you rectify that linker traffic
sharing device? Oh, mostly it says no, rather than target. So the traffic shaping is really connection shaping. And you also hope that the guys who are seeing that Hayes modem worth of bandwidth, the spammers, give up fairly quickly. And in general, they do. Even though they have lots of resources, they're not going to waste your time, sending down a Hayes modem. They have time out, they'll disconnect.
Do you have a sense of any given point how many processes you're about.
Well, so the thing is that in the traffic shaper, in the same bucket that's doing the connection shaping, you say, okay, give these people, you know, his modem worth of bandwidth. You also define how many connections in that pool total are allowed to exist. So long as that's not more than one half or a tenth or whatever of my total process count, okay, so 20% of my processes are doing Hayes modem traffic. But the other 80% are handling the good guys. So, you know, it's fine. So as long as I don't oversubscribe the targeted guys, I'm in good shape. So the fact that the appliance lets you reserve, you know, connection counts for various pools, and then within that pool shape the bandwidth, means that you have the opportunity to not target all of your processes.
If it exceeds the number of people in that bucket list, it just...
It resets them, right. Yeah, right. Sorry, yeah, in that pool, then the 200th connection comes in, 201st limits 200, they see a TCP reset. So the traffic shaping stuff is cool. I know how to defeat it, but I'm not going to talk about that. So thankfully, the spammers aren't defeating it right now. RBL, right, RBL lookup delay, again, if you have severe RBL lookup delays, pay Stackhouse the money, bring it in locally, or use few RBLs. Certainly don't use dead RBLs. There's still plenty of people using, you know, RBLs that have disappeared 5 years ago, even if it's some people's configurations. You know, whatever. Recipient validation lookups, oops, sorry, can slow you down. This thing, all right. I think we're spending too much time on that slide anyway, but all kinds of things can slow you down on the input side. If you're analyzing this input congestion where you're trying to connect to your MTA and you're finding all the servers tied up, slow to connect, slow to get banner, these are the kind of issues that you have to worry about. Inflow delay is interesting, but it probably should not talk about it. We talked about this kind of latency at dot, that's when POSIX commits the message to stable storage. That's really the cleanup server's job. And if your disk is saturated, you'll see a long delay at dot time. And then finally, for a bunch of Linux users, I don't think it's as much of an issue for BSD users, the default slot configuration is synchronous for every syslog message. Now what you find is that one postfix mail message, which is synced to disk once, generates about 6 or 7 syslog messages as it goes through the various daemons, and each of those is synced to disk. So syslog, you know, hits the disk about 7 times harder than the MTA, and pretty rapidly you're out of disk bandwidth just to syslog. That's very embarrassing. And you get into, you know, input stalling because SMTP servers are all blocked waiting for the syslog socket to drain. Oh, the syslog socket, even though it's UDP and even in datagraph mode, blocks. Things are really pathetic in that environment. Don't do that. Alright. How am I doing on time, by the way? This is a pretty detailed talk. You guys let me know if I'm absurdly slow. So how do you measure your input performance? Your logs are your most valuable source of intelligence on what your MTA is doing. If you want to understand the average lifetime of a connection that's brought in by a client, you'll be looking at the SMTP server log messages. And the SMTP server logs the beginning of a connection, connect from, the end of a connection, disconnect from. And then these intermediate lines of the QID and client equals. Whenever it generates a new Q file, a new mail transaction, it generates one of these, you know, client equals log lines. If the same session has another one just like it, that means that actually that SMTP server handled 2 messages, the connection got reused. It has 3 of them, it handled 3 messages, the connection got reused. If you're trying to estimate the amount of time it takes to do a mail transaction on the input side, then you'll want to break it down and actually count the gaps from connect from to client equals to next client equals and so on to disconnect and count each of those as separate transactions, and then you'll know the average latency of a transaction and you know how fast mail can come in per channel into your input system and how to scale your concurrency so you can achieve a particular input rate of messages. If on the other hand, you're worried about what's the average lifetime of connections, how many servers do I have, can I work out my connection throughput that way, and when will I be saturated in terms of connection use, then you might ignore these client equals lines and just look at the average time between a client connect and disconnect, you learn what it's like. If you suddenly notice that those average times get a lot longer, that would be an interesting data point. Something's changed. All of a sudden, people are spending a lot more time connected to you. Maybe you want to figure out who they are or something, or in any case, try and reduce this amount or raise the concurrency to compensate for the fact that now your MTA has transitioned into a new operating mode. Previously, connections last in half a second. Now, connections last 20 seconds. Oops. We live in a different world. When connections last 20 seconds, you need to tune your MTA differently than when connections last half a second. So that's an important thing to be able to measure. Certainly, you can measure the SMTP response latency. You can just send a probe, connect, measure how long it took, measure how long the banner takes to appear, measure how long it takes to do a hello response, and disconnect. That would be a pretty good monitoring probe to do periodically that monitors the responsiveness of your MTA as viewed by a potential outside client. The POSIX since 2.3 has fine-grained delay logging, and it logs four different delay numbers. We call them sort of the ABCD delays. The A delay, the first number that's logged, is the amount of time that elapsed from the message, in some sense being created from the mail from command that created the message, until it enters the active queue. This is a useful number for the first time the message entered the active queue. When it's been lying around in the deferred queue a long time and comes back again, it's no longer that interesting a number, because it now reflects the fact that it's been lying in the deferred queue for minutes to hours. But if your log analyzer is smart enough, it'll be able to notice which messages are recycled from the deferred queue and which messages are not. And in that case, the A numbers for just the fresh messages give you a good sense of how long it takes for a message to get sent into your system and be processed by the queue manager switch and enter the active queue. So you get the sum of input stage plus switch stage. And you can look at use something like Moon or some sort of graphing system and look for sudden changes in this particular latency, the A latency, for non-deferred messages. And if you suddenly see a very different place in the graph where you're living than where you normally live, that again would be a reason for concern and time to investigate and retune your MTA or improve your defenses or whatever, or find that stupid application that's hammering your server to death. Usually your own, rather than somebody else's. As I mentioned, process counts aren't terribly useful, but counting established connections with a local endpoint of TCP 25, that would be a pretty good way of determining how many connections are concurrent in your system at any given moment. And then the size of your incoming queue measures to what extent the queue manager is not able to keep up with bringing mail into the active queue. There's another reason why the incoming queue might start to grow, which is when the active queue is full. The active queue, as we'll see in a moment, represents memory. All things that involve memory and postfix are bounded, they have explicit bounds, so that you don't have attackers crashing the system when you're out of memory. And so the active queue is finite. When it fills up, ultimately the incoming queue will fill up too. When the parking lot at the airport is completely full, and the cars are waiting on the highway exit to get on, to get to the airport, eventually the highway will back up as well. So the incoming queue is sort of like your highway, and the active queue is, the lounges or whatever at the airport, with people, go to various gates. We can do all kinds of fancy things in terms of algorithms and scheduling and so on in the active queue. If you can't even get into the active queue, all bets are off. And that can happen in part when the active queue fills up. Stress behavior. I talked a lot about stress behavior already. This lovely file, stressreadme.html, on the Postfix website. Take a look at it. If you find that your input is totally saturated, this is the guide for you. You can add concurrency, as I mentioned, up to potentially 10,000 SMTP servers to make it cringe. That requires KQ support or EPOL support on Linux or DevPol support on Solaris. All of those are available in sufficiently recent Postfix releases, running and compiled on sufficiently recent versions of the operating system. The compiled on part is important. You take the same release of Postfix, build it on an old platform that's binary compatible, bring it forward, but Postfix doesn't know that your platform supports these wonderful APIs and isn't using them. So you've got to build your postfix on the platform that you're using. Not generally, probably on BSDs, you build everything from source, right? So package source, build, you know, you're done. So reduce latency, right? Session lifetime, all these kinds of things are good things to do when you're under stress. Postfix does not, unlike sendmail, do anything nearly as stupid as refusal A or QLA. Refusal A and QLA have the slight difficulty that they stop doing all work when a system is under stress. Rather than doing a finite and bounded amount of work and still getting stuff out, it just stops dead. And the general consequence of this is that it wakes up later and there's even more work to do. And things don't get any better. QLA is just too sudden a cutoff. You want to reach a plateau of the amount of work you're attempting to do, but that's not a good time to stop processing. And refusal A and QLA stop processing, and what's more, they respond to completely the wrong information system load average, which is minutes too old, in any case, maybe not even the MTA's fault. Maybe some, you know, some IMAP user maybe doing whatever it is that they're doing, not necessarily a good reason to stop the MTA. No refusal A or QLA bogosity. Sendmail, because you know, it's a whole bunch of processes, ships in the night, has no way to manage its concurrency. So it does these really bizarre, you know, attempts at trying to manage system load, but they're futile. And so the system collapses a lot more readily. Alright. Content inspection. So we have pre-queue content inspection. Pre-queue content inspection happens during input and creates CPU load when you're taking in mail. So when your CPU is saturated, that's it, you can't take any more mail. And you can't really predict the load which external parties will throw at you. You might find yourself, you know, with 1,000 messages coming in simultaneously, all of them, you know, very large, and your content, your inspection engine's falling over, and other people are unable to send you mail during this time and having to disconnect and try again later because you're totally saturated. They don't scale nearly as well, they do have the advantage that if your stress behavior is not a transient thing, like somebody, you know, decided to send you lots of stuff for 5 minutes and then they're going to go away, that during those 5 minutes, you know, you seem to be down to the whole world, you come back up, so these filters don't look so good. They are, however, not a bad idea if the immense load that's being thrown at you is steady and continuous. Because if you take the stuff into your queue and then try and process this load, and you still, you know, don't have the resources, now your queue is just growing indefinitely, and you're failing to push back and say, no, I cannot handle this rate, and maybe your backup MX can handle that rate, or another box right next to you can handle that rate, or whatever. Sometimes it's appropriate to, in fact, push the stress behavior in the reverse direction, rather than taking it very fast, yes, give me more, but then be completely unprepared to deal with it. So postfix normally does content inspection after queue, and this scales much better for bursts. But pre-queue inspection is arguably better for pushing back on load that is steady and that you cannot avoid. So you'll just go as fast as you're going. Of course, if that's how fast you're going, you're essentially down all the time. So who wants to be operating in that mode anyway? My view is that these kind of filters really work best in very large environments, you know, server farms of hundreds of machines behind load balancers. You know, the Yahoos and AOLs of this world do everything pre-queue, and they've got enough hardware to throw at the problem. They're unlikely to be saturated by anybody who's not as big as they are. So they can afford to do all of this pre-queue filtering. I mostly, see load profiles that are not of the sort that I, you know, can't afford to queue whatever burst comes my way and work it off later. I'm not constantly stressed. And I don't want to not accept mail and miss tiny time-sensitive stuff when somebody happens to want to throw a lot of mail my way. I'd rather queue it. And tell them, yes, I've got it, go away, shut up, hopefully soon. Yes?
When I was reading about this, there's something about the way spam is rejected in pre-queue compared to post-queue.
Yes.
if you reject it with prequeue, then you can send a bounce message. So if someone...
Right. I have that somewhere here. If you do prequeue, you can reject. If you do post-queue filtering, you don't reject, really. I mean, you could be antisocial and reject, but the right thing is not to reject. The best you can do is tag or quarantine. Tagging gives the user the opportunity to refile it for their junk folder, but still delivers it to them. Quarantine, you know, keeps it on the sideline somewhere, gives the user a periodic notice. You've got 200,000 messages in your quarantine. You know, go look for some spam if you want to. You know, that kind of thing. We're not sending it back, it's quarantined. So, you know, these are the trade-offs.
Email
is UDP. Email is always UDP, even before any of this stuff. Although certainly anti-spam measures, you know, are far worse in some cases than the spam, when they're poorly thought out. But email is UDP. If you have something important, send it. You know, make a phone call or request confirmation. You know, maybe it's too much to say in one phone call, right? But it's important that it arrive. Make a phone call.
It's really bad in the long term because people are sending text messages or Facebook messages or instant message nonsense because the email is no longer reliable.
Yep. Well, those things aren't terribly reliable.
Email has a maximum reliability without saying that I can. Right. I mean, I think that's reliable. But there's a big difference in the eventual perceived reliability of email from which one of these two you pick.
Somewhat, although, you know, eventually the question is how many bounces do people really read in this world with all the backscatter and so on. So even if you reject and send a bounce, does that really improve reliability? Possibly not. Possibly it's worse. At least some people actually review their quarantine. If they, you know, have important things that they deal with. So anyway, pre-queue, Milter and proxy filter, slightly different technologies. Milter is a much nastier programming environment. A lot more bugs due to the threading issues and so on. But a lot more available software in the form of Milters because of the dominant market position of Sendmail. And particularly because of the appearance of DKIM milters and SPF milters and all that sort of stuff, it was impractical to try and bolt all that technology with a separate implementation for postfix. And so we reneged on no milters here and added milters so to placate that crowd so they can go away and mind their own business. And so we have milter support. Not encouraging you to do milters unless you're particularly keen on DKIM. DKIM is a waste of time, so don't do DKIM, don't do milters, and be happy. However, if you absolutely need to get whitelisted by Yahoo, and you want to send them piles and piles of mail, okay, maybe you have to do DKIM, and then maybe you need to do some of this stuff. Checking DKIM, waste of time. Spammers have more DKIM than the good guys, and you know, it's just a waste of time. If you're a large ISP and you want a whitelist, and you want a whitelist by domain rather than by IP, and you want to have domain owners sign up for your whitelist, then again you'll need DKIM. Very few people in this room are another Yahoo who need this kind of technology to manage their whitelists. Okay. Post-queue content filters, as I mentioned, you queue the mail, it gets delivered to the filters in a measured, you know, pace controlled by your system. If mail arrives faster than you can process it, it queues up and then hopefully the surge dies down and the mail drains out. So you have a little spike in the latency as mail accumulates in front of the filter. The spike is over, mail drains from the filter and latency returns to normal. You can measure this latency in your logs. You can see how long mail has been sitting around waiting to be filtered by looking at some of these ABCD timers. We'll look at that in a minute. And of course, the moment you introduce filtering, I've seen very few MTAs that do any sort of realistic filters that are still I.O. constrained rather than CPU constrained. Pretty much immediately you hit the brick wall. You know, antivirus, anti-spam, whatever, game over, CPU. You want more performance, more boxes, more CPU. Okay, this is sort of low level. Maybe I should skip it. I want to talk about why Postfixq files are designed the way they are. They're designed fairly well, never mind. So the incoming queue. This may be a good time to ask, you know, is this stuff about the right level? Am I going to go faster, slower, switch topics? Yes.
How much is that?
I don't know. How much time do we have? How long do people live here?
Really tired.
I'm good.
One question about the queues.
Right.
You know, as you're adjusting and tuning, you might have a certain failure. You know, what do you have a good way of testing? Do you clone off your incoming mail and?
Oh, that kind of testing. Yeah, I have at times done things like use always BCC to take a large, you know, day's worth of incoming mail and store it on the server somewhere. Huh?
So BCC sounds good.
I mean, if you want a realistic mail stream to replay, we've done that. So I have, you know, about 150 gigabytes of mail saved up from one day or so, you know, can replay. And periodically, it's like, well, that sample is too old, time to collect a new one. Test servers are the place where you test, ideally. Incoming queue. The incoming queue is mail that entered the postfix queue, the client is gone, it's sitting there, it's waiting for the queue manager to figure out where it's going to send it, which transport to the next hop, and when. Before the queue manager makes those decisions, it's sitting in the incoming queue waiting to be gathered up by the queue manager. Every message that enters the incoming queue exactly once, it gets processed by cleanup, gets assigned a queue ID. That queue ID gets created in the incoming queue. If you're a sophisticated log parser, you can detect queue ID reuse by noticing cleanup logging a previously seen queue ID again as having re-entered the queue. That's not the same queue ID anymore. It's a new message that just happened to get the same queue ID. The QID is likely to get reused moderately often in a high-volume system, especially if the output drains pretty fast if you don't have large backlogs, because a part of the thing that makes the QID unique is its inode number, and so long as messages are draining out of your system fast enough, you've got a small working set of inodes, the same inode getting reused for mail messages all the time. The only other thing that keeps a QID unique in the current implementation is a microsecond timestamp. So the inode number is actually going to get reused rapidly. And this might even be a very small 10 or 20 inodes on some systems that just get used for every single mail message. In which case, you know, as soon as you happen to accept a message on the right clock tick, you get reused with a QID. It'll happen at least 1 second later. But in practice, it happens a few times a day in a busy system. If you're a particularly topological system, it may happen more often. If you're doing crazy things like archiving and spooling mail and, you know, creating lots of new files in the system and so on that you expire 60 days later and, you know, all that kind of stuff, then your inodes circulate over much longer lifetimes. And then QID reuse is less frequent. Not that I'm suggesting that's a good way to tune your system, but, you know, the frequency of QID reuse really depends on what the system's up to. So the incoming queue, that's the brunt of the I/O cost of a normal non-CPU constrained MTA, creates a file, renames it, writes to it, chmods it, syncs it. However fast you can do those operations in your kernel and your disk, that's how fast you can accept mail into your incoming queue.
And everything else happens from cache memory.
All right. Everything else happens from cache memory. When mail enters the incoming queue, the cleanup server normally sends the queue manager a one-byte message saying, wake up, you queue manager, there's something in the incoming queue. Now, not every single one of those one-byte messages requires a lot of work from the queue manager. In fact, the cleanup server is completely willing for that one-byte message to be lost when the queue manager FIFO is full. Because that message says, wake up, you queue manager, there's something to do. Well, if there are already lots of messages in that FIFO saying, wake up, queue manager, there's lots of stuff to do, then yours is completely redundant. What the queue manager does is then scan the incoming queue until it comes to the end and scan every message. If one or more wake-up events arrive in the meantime, I'll just start a new scan when the previous scan completes. On a busy enough system, the scans are continuous. It doesn't depend on the number of wake-up events. It just means that by the time you finish scanning the incoming queue, another wake-up event has arrived, so you're going to keep scanning it in the loop. If the incoming queue is larger, you just keep scan until it empties. And in the meantime, mail is arriving, so you're getting lots of events that prevent you from stopping the scan. If on the other hand, you totally drain the incoming queue, you're not going to sit there in the loop looking for files in it. That's not very efficient. So you're going to wait for one of these wake-up timers from the cleanup server. Or alternatively, just in case things are really broken, the master daemon will send the queue manager one of these wake-up timers once every 5 minutes. But we don't really rely on that. That's a safety catch. The important thing is that the cleanup server wakes the queue manager up. If you want to, you can actually use the post-tick command that most people have never seen to send them these wake-up timers explicitly, whatever. So the queue manager sort of scans the incoming queue. It also scans the deferred queue, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Alright. This is the important part of POSIX. It actually has a queue manager, like SendMail, and I don't think XM has a queue manager either. QMail has sort of like queue manager like beast. But XM and SendMail lack one. The important thing about the active queue is that it's primarily an in-core queue. The actual directory called active is an implementation artifact. Just the way it happens to be convenient to move the files around as they, make the transition from being incoming to being active. Different designs are possible, but every mail message that's in the active queue has an in-core representation that stores at least a window into the recipients of the message, I think about 10,000 or so at a time, or 1,000 at a time. So those are all stored in memory, and then all the transports are stored in memory, one sort of data structure for a transport, and then within each transport, there are data structures for each destination, each next hop, that transport will deliver. Delivery happens round robin per transport. So if you have two different transports, the queue manager will schedule normally a delivery, transport A, transport B, transport A, transport B, provided, of course, that there are any messages to be sent in each transport. It looks around for each transport saying, do you have anything now? If all the destinations for that transport are busy, it'll skip it, and keep sending the transport that's not congested. But one way, if you have destinations where you want to achieve some sort of priority, right? Because let's say you have inbound mail and outgoing mail, but you don't want outgoing mail to start incoming mail. Then one thing that you could do is assign incoming mail to a different transport, just by name. It doesn't have to be an actually different mechanism. It can be, again, SMTP under a different name. And what that does is it creates a different pool of processes and a separately scheduled set of destination queues that are done on a round-robin basis collectively for the entire transport relative to the entire output side. So you kind of get 50-50 balance between input and output, whereas if you stick them all on one transport, you might naively find that the workload is spread across all destinations, but your input destination has a lot more work to do and could get starved. In fact, that behavior was in fact happening in the original POSIX queue manager circa 2001. But two things happened to ameliorate this. One was that the new queue manager was introduced, which is FIFO, in its scheduling strategy by default. And that means that high volume destinations get scheduled more often just out of the box because there's a lot more mail in the queue at those particular time slots. So a bit of fairness in that regard. And the other thing that happened was that by default, if you play the game right, if you label your incoming domains as relay domains, they get served by the relay transporters, a clone of SMTP that's different in name only. And so again, you get much better handling of incoming mail that doesn't get starved by outbound mail. The outbound mail mostly gets starved, or used to get starved at the time, from backscatter, if you didn't have good recipient validation. And so you had all this garbage waiting to bounce back to the internet. The garbage could tie up all of your delivery slots for your SMTP delivery transport, and then you would find that you have a completely idle MTA doing bugger all. You have piles of mail waiting to arrive for your users desperate to receive it, but POSIX is sitting there doing nothing because all the SMTP delivery agents are busy. Don't want to be there. So first of all, you tune yourself to a situation where ideally you have a lot less backscatter, or if you do, you have much better ways of tolerating it. And then secondly, separation of input and output transports can help this, and certainly the new queue manager helps as well. Each destination gets scheduled in a reasonably gentle way. We open a finite number of connections to the destination, building up the connection pool, at least in theory, somewhat gradually. And as we learn that the destination really is accepting mail, the concurrency allocation for the destination grows to a finite limit, and then messages that are not able to be scheduled immediately, certainly active queue, wait for mail that arrives before them in time. This is the FIFO scheduling strategy. Wait for those to drain, and then they go. So messages kind of leave in about the same order as they arrive. So that's FIFO scheduler. Postfix reload. Some people like to make configuration changes all day long, or in any case, just every 5 minutes, cron job reload, must be time to reload. Maybe they have some job that rebuilds their config files automatically and then does reload just in case it's necessary. Now, if you have a large queue, all of the state the queue manager has accumulated in core for potentially tens to hundreds of thousands of messages, whatever, is lost because the queue manager has to reload. And all of the files move out of the active queue back into the incoming queue so that the queue manager can re-import them again, because only node has one way of bringing stuff into the active queue, and has to find it in the incoming queue. And instead of programming a way of recovering the active queue in a very nasty way, you kind of reduce the problem of how to boil the kettle. You turn off the light and then you light it, and then you boil the kettle. Yes?
There's a different way to actually commit the active queue back to disk.
What do you mean by commit it back to disk?
Say that you only do a process real estate, there's no way for it holding. Say, put it to disk, why? I know it kind of sounds ineffective for some situations, but
I'm just curious. You'd get confused easily about what's an active queue that you just moved in yourself and what's an active queue that was there before, and it gets pretty nasty. Although, if we introduce that hash that we were just talking about today. But anyway. So reloading a busy queue is a disaster. Do not reload busy queues. Also, another favorite saying of mine that somehow didn't end up in this talk, do not flush congested queues. I live in a New York City apartment. I've lived in a number of New York City apartments. Some of them have poor plumbing. When your toilet gets congested, the last thing you want to do is flush. Right? Because instead of the mess being in the bowl, the mess is now on the floor, where it's far less pleasant. Right? So do not flush a congested toilet. Clear the blockage, then flush. This applies to postfix fairly well. If your queue is congested and unable to perform deliveries, and there's a pile of junk that delivers poorly sitting in a deferred queue, would it be a lot better if all that toxic junk that slows down delivery also end up in the active queue? Well, the answer is no. That would not be a much better situation. Things only get worse. And so you really only want to flush the queue when you have a good reason to believe that things that used to happen that caused the mail to be deferred are no longer happening. You've already solved some fundamental problem. You've brought your internal MTAs back online. You've debugged them. They're ready to receive mail. It's now time to flush. Otherwise, people who think, oh, gee, Postfix is slow delivering my mail, must be time to flush, are in for a big disappointment. Nothing good happens when they flush. And reload is not particularly a better strategy for fixing problems either. You really have to fix the problem, and then you can flush and reload and the like. So you have to find out what the problem is. Deferred queue. The deferred queue holds all the stuff that we've tried, and didn't have much luck with, but it kept failed. It didn't bounce. We tried to deliver it. The other guy was down, or he was up, and didn't have resources or whatever. We're going to have to retry this stuff. Worst case, deferred queue has actually theoretically poor scalability. If every single message in the deferred queue goes to a different destination, so that you cannot make any use of Postfix's dead host detection, which when a host is determined to be down for sufficiently many messages in a row, will mark the host's disk and remove all the mail in the active queue for that destination, deferred all preemptively. That way, you're not spending all your resources trying to connect to a dead site over and over and over again, burning those delivery agents that could do real work, trying to reach a dead site. So that's a wonderful algorithm that keeps the queue pretty healthy. However, if every single message in your active or deferred queue, or whatever, in your deferred queue, is to a different destination, that algorithm doesn't work. And there isn't any current way of grouping messages to say, you know, whatever, so sorry. So if that happens, then in theory, whatever your maximum backup time, determines how often you retry a message that's been deferred, you know, try and deliver it again. If that's n, whatever your maximum backup time is, you have to be able to process your entire deferred queue at least once in the maximum backup time. Let's say it's 2 hours. So every message you're trying to, you know, deferred, you're trying to process it again 2 hours later, 4 hours later, 6 hours later, and so on. So the entire deferred queue, sometimes during a 2 hour interval, will enter the active queue and leave it. So your throughput for deferred mail has to be such that the size of the deferred queue has to be processed in that 2 hour interval. If your concurrency is C and your latency for delivery is L, then the maximum size of the deferred queue, in theory, is the maximum backup time times your concurrency divided by latency. It has the right dimensions, by the way, because your maximal backup time has units of time, your concurrency is some dimensionless scalar, just a count, latency is time again, so I end up with a scalar, nice, the number of messages. So if one plugs in the numbers, let's suppose you have a 2 hour maximum backup time, and you have 150 seconds of latency to decide that a site can't be delivered to because you've got 5 dead MX hosts and you're spending 30 seconds timing out to reach each one. So you've got 150 seconds of latency. And suppose you want to throw 500 delivery agents busy trying to time out these 5 MX hosts. Then you find that your deferred queue will saturate at 25,000 messages. And you will no longer be able to process those 25,000 messages in 2 hours. And what's more, no other mail will get processed during those 2 hours either, because all your delivery agents are busy. Now, in practice, things aren't nearly that bad. And the dead host algorithms and various other things are, you know, help you. And not every dead host has 5 MX hosts, and not always is it a 30-second timeout, and so on. So in practice, you may find that your deferred queue scales to 100,000 or even a million messages. But at some point, this disease doesn't go away. The deferred queue has a realistic bound. You cannot defer 100 million messages and have a working postfix MTA. Maybe you can't manage 25,000. Maybe you're in that extreme case where everything has gone wrong against you and 25,000 is about the limit. The symptoms of that would be, actually, that messages don't actually anymore enter the active queue every 2 hours. Because it takes longer to, you know, an active queue fills up, and so you'll find that you'll bring them in every 4, every 8, whatever. As the deferred queue grows at some point, once it exceeds the realistic size limit that, you know, works for your workload, you'll be trying them less often. But unfortunately, at that point, your active queue will be so full that you'll see large latencies, not only for the deferred mail recycling, but also for incoming mail being processed because your active queue is full. It would be nice to reserve a portion of the active queue for non-deferred mail. We haven't done that yet. And not too many people are running into this problem. It's a theoretical problem. Lovely thing about theoretical problems is you don't necessarily need to solve every single one. And there's a clear solution, which is to say that once my active queue has, let's say, 80% of mail in it that's been deferred, maybe I stop scanning the deferred queue until that number drops down, have high and low watermarks. Problem solved, easy enough, someday if it's necessary. That problem remains unsolved for the moment. In practice, that's solved in theory, so I'm a mathematician. It's a solved problem. We're done, right? So in practice, however, as I was saying, the deferred queue scales up to about 100,000 messages with ease, a million messages, you know, some hosts under some conditions. And up to that, you're unhappy. Because the deferred queue has a scale limit, you don't really want to let it get completely out of whack. And so on a host that's doing lots of mail, you might want to take mail that's getting deferred and move it out of the primary queue. Keep the primary queue healthy. And we have this SMTP fallback relay thing that lets you say that when an SMTP delivery to the primary next hop fails, this is really for gateway, busy gateways, send it to the cesspool server. It's going to process the cesspool and not really going to be involved in the processing of the main mail stream. And so the main mail stream gets processed fast, and the cesspool server has lots of disk and maybe much higher concurrency limits, ideally in the expectation that most of its mail is going to be slow, and so these higher concurrency limits aren't actually going to thrash the system. There's just going to be a large number of data structures in the kernel waiting for some future event, 30-second timeout. But it's okay to run, let's say, 10,000 SMTP delivery agents in this time.
Because they're doing nothing anyway.
So you can tune your SMTP fallback relay for a much higher concurrency. You can might also lower its timeouts. You know, you'll be breaking RFC recommendations about how long should the connect timeout be. But on the other hand, you know, how many places do you connect to where it takes 30 seconds to do a TCP three-way handshake? You know, maybe 5 seconds is enough for a TCP three-way handshake. Maybe even two. You know, although two gets you sort of, you know, uncomfortably close to, you know, Australia over satellite link and that kind of thing. But 30 is generous, and you can at least lower that one. And you can play around with some of the other timers. So as I said, SMTP fallback relay, you can reduce the number of hosts you try to connect to. You'll round robin them anyway, so even if you don't try a particular host on the first time in the active queue, you'll defer it, bring it back, try it next time. There'll be a different host next time. Yes? Right, address, right, exactly. So POSIX randomizes the order of records, so you don't have to try them all the first time, but you should try at least two. Especially if they're silly and they have, unnecessarily prioritized the next host 10, 20, 30, 40, even though they're all equally good, but they'll force you to always try the same one first each time, just because somebody told them that's how you do a next record. And in that case, you know, if the first host is slow, you know, you might not actually be able to deliver the mail. And so you should try at least two. Connect timeout, all of that kind of stuff, right? We talked about this. Output. Postfix output is done by delivery agents. These are the funny things in master.cf. Not everything in master.cf is a delivery agent. Some people think that Bounce is a delivery agent and various other internal services are delivery agents. Some people comment them out and then wonder that the system doesn't work anymore. So there are really only 9 delivery agents in the latest Postfix. Local, virtual, and pipe do final delivery. They actually put stuff in mailboxes, at least in theory. Although local doesn't has the capability to put it back in the queue, alias expansion and reforwarding. But virtual and pipe deliver stuff to a process or deliver it to a file, and then it's gone. SMTP, relay, and LMTP, pretty obvious, they deliver mail. SMTP and relay are really the same thing. They exist as separate entities, like I said, because it's actually a good idea to split the transport between inbound and outbound mail and maybe tune them differently. Maybe all your relay destinations are very near you and you can afford short connect timeouts. Much better, and maybe higher concurrencies. When sending to yourself, maybe 100 parallel deliveries from your gateway to your internal mail cluster is the right number. Maybe 500 is the right number. And then you can, you know, amortize the latency cost that way. Error, retry, and discard are internal services. Error will bounce every message. Retry will attempt to fail every message. And discard will throw away every message, always succeed. So you have guaranteed failure, guaranteed success, and guaranteed attempt failure. Three degenerate delivery agents. right. Multi-recipient atomicity. This is an important thing. In the first three delivery agents, pretty much always are really for one recipient at a time. There's no good way of delivering two recipients, you know, to two local mailboxes as a single transaction. The Unix file system doesn't provide a, you know, begin transaction, you know, do two deliveries, end transaction kind of semantic. And so as a result, If PostFix is delivering one, you know, two recipients at the same time for local, and one fails, and we're trying to make it one transaction, it'd be bad news because it would have to retry the same thing again, and maybe one of them succeeded, you'll deliver to him twice. In fact, this happens when people create stupidly large aliases with no owner alias. Because when there's no owner alias in PostFix and all the aliases are delivered locally, the alias expansion happens on the fly in memory. You've only got one recipient alias to deliver to, that has to succeed or fail. You succeed to a subset of the list, you fail to one of the members, the delivery has therefore failed. You have to back off and retry from the queue, but the queue file doesn't store which recipients were in the alias or not. Unlike sendmail, PostFix doesn't modify its queue file after the input stage with all the horrors that go on there. There are many good reasons why it doesn't do that. I can't really go into them all. And so alias expansion from large lists is best done by re-queuing the message with the expanded list. And that's what happens with owner aliases or with colon include colon. But in any case, a local virtual and pipe process one recipient at a time. But with pipe, it's not automatic. You have to configure it for your various pipes. Some pipes can process multiple recipients, wire scanner pipes and the like. They'll re-queue it. But pipes that really deliver, really should deliver one recipient at a time. So your concurrency is not going to be concurrency, not in terms of messages, but in terms of recipients. PostFix scheduling changes when you change the transport to deliver one recipient at a time. A destination is now an individual recipient, not a domain, which means that if some idiot, arranges a mail loop or sends himself from a program, a million messages flooding into his mailbox, other people continue to get mail, by and large, until the active queue is full. Once the active queue is full, nobody else gets mail either, but provided the active queue doesn't fill, one recipient doesn't starve all the other recipients. That's a good feature of PostFix. We already talked about that. We want to talk about what retry is. This is, again, an even less current picture of PostFix output of all these various delivery agents. The most important thing is now comes from the incoming to active, brought there by the queue manager, cycles multiple times through the deferred queue, gets given to all of these various delivery agents. You might notice an error in retry of discard or missing from this picture, but in any case. And also, the relocated table is no longer directly used by the queue manager. It's part of the rewrite service. But this is the stolen picture from VT's old WandaDo documentation. So it's approximately correct. So output performance, it's no longer the A number. The B, C, and D numbers are interesting. You can also use netstat to determine how many outgoing SMTP connections you have. Now you're looking at the remote destination being at 1 to 425 in your TCP state table. And you can count those and determine how many outgoing connections you have at the same time. Again, counting processes is not nearly as accurate because processes linger around and aren't necessarily doing work. The B, C, D times are interesting. B is how long the message is spent sitting around in the active queue waiting to be given to the delivery agent. So if you have a large backlog to destination, you'll see that reflected in that B time. Usually that's the result of large C and D numbers. Because the messages that are actually getting delivered are draining slowly, you get the backlog. So what happens is that you first see a spike in C and D. Latency to a particular site is down because their next host is down or they're slow, whatever. And then, after a while, the B numbers start climbing because longer and longer queues accumulate, waiting for the messages that are being delivered, and gradually what you see, C and D spike, and then B grows. Indefinitely, provided that your output has collapsed. We have monitors inside that monitor C plus D, for various important destinations. In real time, if the C plus D number gets out of whack, alarms go off. Something's wrong.
You use,
connect plus deliver.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what does B stand for?
They're nothing. They're just the four timers that PostFix logs. They don't stand for anything. VT, when you wrote the documentation, said we have four, we have four delay numbers that we log, A, B, C, and D. A is time before active. B is time in the active queue. C is the time that it takes to connect. It's the only one. Oh, sorry. C and D kind of work. C is the time to make the connection. And D is the time to perform the delivery, to do the transaction.
Okay.
So C and D kind of are, you know, work at A and B, nothing. I can't. I guess maybe A is active and B is B. I don't know. I'm making it up. They're just the four times. Before the active queue, in the active queue, time to make a connection, time to complete a delivery. If you understand these and think about them, you can really do very good analysis of why do I have congestion in my output stage. You know, where exactly is the badness happening? Before these numbers were logged, it was very difficult to understand when you're congested as to why it was that a message took 5 seconds to get delivered. Now you'll see, it sat 5 seconds in active queue, then it took a millisecond to get delivered. Oh, that's my problem. No, it took 5 seconds to establish a connection, then a millisecond to get delivered. Oh, I've got to get a host somewhere, all that kind of stuff. So these numbers are sort of the heart of doing performance analysis, is looking at those four numbers. Okay. Noisy destinations. You can have some destinations which accept most mail, but turn away a fraction with a variety of errors. They're overloaded. There are resources. Their disk is failing. You hit one of the five MX hosts is broken. Whatever. So you get you get noisy feedback. Some deliveries succeed, other deliveries fail. Postgres has a feedback mechanism to adjust the concurrency up if everything's going well and down if things aren't going well. The default feedback mechanism is not very stable. So if the site's sufficiently noisy, you may find that you're declaring the site dead even though it's kind of half working. And mail accumulates for the site and gets deferred, and it gets brought back from the active queue and it gets tried again. It's in some ways a smaller version of the refusal accumulate fiasco, although it's not that. But the idea is you're putting off work that you could have been doing, which is not good, because the site isn't actually dead, but you called it dead. And so Q-shaped README has various advice how to deal with such sites that are not entirely dead. And there are, you know, in 2.5, new tunables that allow you to be much less sensitive to this kind of noisy feedback, and you can tune transports dedicated for sites that give you, you know, some good news and some bad news. Maybe even more bad news than good news. And you can tune for that. And when you do that, you're still able to deliver the mail without calling them dead.
Really, I like to think that algorithms don't just, you know, figure things out by themselves. So mostly it works, but then from these really pathological cases, you have a manual control, but it's really inconsistent. It has come to the point that I can no longer help you. So you have to help the system.
Right. Okay, and I think we're getting towards the end here. Connection caching. Connection caching was a fun thing. A long time ago, there was this little company called Google that was having an IPO. And their notion of how to do their IPO was that they would invite the world of small investors to just bid on the IPO in this completely new fancy auction that they invented. And people were envisioning anywhere from 10,000 to 10 million people bidding on this IPO through email and meaning to send random amounts of mail, who knows how much, to all the people on the planet who wanted to buy Google shares. So I figured out that I wasn't going to get the job done without being able to improve dramatically the performance of delivery of mail to Yahoo and Hotmail and AOL and all those folks. And it was clear that connection setup latency, especially to Hotmail, was a big problem because, you know, on average, it takes two or three tries to connect to Hotmail host that's actually responsive rather than saying try again some other time. And in any case, they were doing a lot of their analytics, you know, DNS lookups and the like, and reputation lookups at connect time rather than at message processing time. And so all that latency is pushed back onto you when you're trying to deliver mail to them. So connection reuse was a good thing, and so I built connection reuse, a very simple connection reuse. Each process, each MQTT delivery agent, cached its most recent connection in process, held onto it. And if another message gets scheduled to it for the same destination, piggyback reuse. And then you take your highest volume destinations, and you say, okay, there's a transport dedicated for this guy, a transport dedicated for this guy, and so on. And then ensure that the same SMTP delivery agent is actually going to the same destination next time it gets a request, and the connections were getting reused. And I got, you know, something like 200 to 300 messages a second going through to AOL, no problem. Of course, the IPO was much, much smaller than the 10 million people we've talked about, and I could have done it without connection reuse. But I got the basics of connection reuse built. Then Vitsi took over and did a much better distributed connection manager, the Git file descriptor passing, to move connections out of the SMTP process into a cache daemon and then back again on demand. And unlike SendMail, which caches connections kind of indefinitely and, you know, for no good reason, Postgis caches connections for a very brief time. It disconnects from the other guy. If you're not able to reason connection within 1 or 2 seconds, we say, okay, we don't want to steal precious resources from him, and we don't even bother caching unless we have a backlog for the destination. So if we're able to deliver 20 messages in parallel, and we don't have more than 20 messages in the queue, then, you know, we're able to immediately deliver them all and drain the queue. Why cache any of these connections? We only cache when the backlog exceeds the parallelism of the delivery, so that after we've done the current round of work, there will definitely be more work to do. There's something worth caching the connection for. So because we have a queue manager, we can actually tell whether it's worthwhile caching a connection. And for a typical MTA, most of the time, for most destinations, there's not actually enough demand. You know, with the exception of the AOL and Hotmail, there's no need for me to cache a connection to any one of your individual vanity domains, because some employee somewhere in one of my departments knows you and sends you one message a day, and I'm going to hang on to a connection to you for 5 minutes after they sent that one mail in the hope that maybe they'll send another one within 5 minutes. Well, they won't. So Postfix does connection caching smartly, and so that's nice, but the real benefit of connection caching is when you have a large pool of MX hosts and one of them is down. So maybe your connect latency is typically, you know, 1/10 of a second, 100 milliseconds to connect. But then one of two MX hosts is down, it takes you 30 seconds to detect that it's down and try the other guy. So now your average connection latency has gone from 100 milliseconds to 15 seconds. And if throughput equals connection over latency, you've just increased your latency 150 times. This can have a dramatic effect on throughput. Connection caching amortizes that cost by taking a connection that you've established and reusing it lots of times. Each time you reuse it as a divisor, taking that average latency back down towards zero. So it's a very important thing when you have MX pools without load balancers and any other fancy hide the failure kind of thing going on, where some of the hosts in the connection pool may not be available. Makes, you know, a huge difference in collapse of throughput or non-collapse of throughput when one of the NMX hosts for a site disappears. And disappears by becoming non-responsive as an IP address. So it's a good thing. We first did connection caching where we used the connection 10 or 20 times or something and then dropped it. And then it turned out that in some edge cases, you could have not a dead host, but a slow host. So a connection, it accepts connections, but then takes long, lots of times to process each one. And then what happens is, you're caching these connections, and the hosts that are fast, you drop the connections fairly quickly because they process lots of mail. And the host that's slow accepts connections and hangs on to them, and hangs on to more, and hangs on to more. And eventually your entire pool of concurrency of connections for the site is going to the slow host, because it's slow enough to accumulate them all. So this wasn't a good thing, and I've observed this a few times, and so we changed to time-based connection reuse instead of space count-based connection reuse. So we reuse connections for about 5 minutes or something like that, and then drop them. And that avoids this imbalance. Unfortunately, stupid people like Yahoo and so on insist on limiting your ability to reuse the connection to a particular count. And so we can't win. Right, the anti-spam measures beat the, you know, the right thing to do in terms of getting good performance. So if you run into a site that's fighting you, okay, if their MX hosts are down, you know, you're going to have to pour throughput to them. Fortunately, they tend to be something in the same site that have little big-time load balancers and so on. So it's not a problem in that case. But connection reuse is important. Connection reuse is incompatible, unfortunately, with TLS. don't have a solution for that one yet. Because connection reuse has connections moving in and out of process, but the open SSL library doesn't let you move the session state in and out of process. They don't serialize the data structures, the current state of the ciphers and all of that. Sorry. You can cache session keys, disconnect and reconnect. That's nice, it avoids PKI computations, but it doesn't avoid reconnecting. And I haven't figured out whether there's any good way, or, well, I don't think it would work for most MTAs anyway, to negotiate down to a null cipher. So that you could then negotiate back up to a null cipher, and you wouldn't need any keys. In theory, it's possible, but I think most of the peer implementations wouldn't let you do that. They are insecure, sorry, you know, won't let you down to negotiate to e-null. Although it would be nice.
Suspicious.
Yeah, I don't think it'll work. I mean, we can make postfix be able to negotiate down to null cipher with postfix. So TLS, unfortunately, if you're doing TLS, you don't get connection caching. Not much I can do unless the OpenSSL guys get their act together to make it possible to serialize a connection state together with the file script to shove it off to a different process, have it start up again. The other thing is to build the TLS proxies. We're not really interested in that either.
Yeah, the thing you were saying about the assigning relay for just the other.
Yes.
The connection caching feature makes that unnecessary, right?
The connection caching feature makes it largely unnecessary to do that. Yes.
Current postfix really doesn't need special relay, special tuning for like Hotmail and Yahoo.
Well, no, what they can do is that they sometimes do non-RFC compliant restrictions on how fast you're able to send them mail, how many concurrent sessions you're allowed to have with them. If you're on their whitelist, they might limit you to one parallel connection to Yahoo. You know, 10 recipients a minute, crazy things like that. So if they're really beating you over the head with non-RFC limits, then you do need that. Connection caching is not the only thing you need to worry about. So sometimes people actually try and send high volumes of mail to Yahoo, and you try and fly below the radar and not get on their whitelist and try and work around it on the sending side. I think they're either spammers or morons. You know, if they're not spammers, get on the whitelist. Why the hell are you jumping through these stupid hoops? It's not that hard to get into these programs. It doesn't cost money, you just have to work with them, you know, and not spam them, and then you'll stay on their whitelist.
If they only bought spam coming out of their network as much as they bought a couple games,
probably. Well, yeah, but, you know, but the point is that they think that they don't need to worry about it because they're big enough, and largely that's true. And this is the last thing, that these traffic shaping destinations like Yahoo. So get whitelisted. Then there's this crazy table here. What is this crazy table? Well, this is the new feedback control in Postfix 2.5, where you can scale down the amount of positive and negative feedback by a factor. So for example, the default Postfix strategy reduces the connection concurrency by one for each failure and increases it by one for each failure. If instead you say no, reduce the connection concurrency by 1/20th for each failure, and do it on the first failure, and then don't do anything for the next 19, and then do it again after 20. While on the positive side, you have to have 20 consecutive successes before you increase your window by 1. So you check the schedule up to 1 over 20 positive, 1 over 20 negative. What happens is you'll find that you're able to tolerate much higher noise level. Your probability of actually consistently moving up or consistently moving down is about one and a half out of 1,000 if the error rate is 1 in 3.6. That's the critical error rate where your probabilities of going up and down are equal. So if suppose you have 5 MX hosts, and one of them is rejecting all the mail, and 4 of them are saying yes. So your error rate is 1 in 4. If your error rate is 1 in 4, it's below the critical value, and your connection concurrency will grow ever so slowly. If your error rate is bigger than 1 in 3, in this configuration, your connection concurrency will decrease down to the minimum value, which is 1. It'll decrease there very, very slowly because the odds of actually jumping back and forth are very low. I have a Perl program which computes all these odds for this oscillator. It's a very difficult problem to solve exactly. So I actually have a sort of Newton-Raphson-like, sorry, a half interval search to find these critical probabilities. But anyway, the interesting thing here is that the scattered acoustics algorithm has a 50-50 probability of going up and down at an error rate of 50%. If the error rate exceeds 50%, it collapses and declares the site dead. If the error rate exceeds, if the error is below 50%, it grows rapidly to large values regardless of what's going on. It's very unstable. Also, when it's doing that, when you get negative feedback, you're deferring a lot of mail. You know, 50% of your mail or so on might be deferred. It turns out that some of these other numbers, which you can play with, and it's described to some extent in the scheduler readme algorithm, will adjust to sites that want to limit your concurrency. So if you go above the number of connections they want, and they rapidly tell you, sorry, you've got too many, drop back down, these new scheduler strategies will approximately converge to the concurrency they want, and you'll only defer 1 over n messages rather than 50%. And so this is something to play with. Almost nobody's using this. I'm not sure how many people really need it, but it's there just in case. It might have a better shot at working with the Yahoos of this world in a semi-automatic fashion. I might recommend something like this 8-20 scenario, where your negative feedback is negative 1/20th and your positive feedback is 1/8th. And you'll find that you can tolerate a fair amount of error, about the same error rate as the standard 1-1 strategy, but be much slower in your growth and much more stable, and defer less mail when the site is pushing back. If you're curious about this, send me an email. I'll send you the little Perl script that does these calculations and maybe even with an explanation of what it means. Of course, if somebody's really traffic shaping, you're at the gunpoint and you can't do anything else, there is a feature in Postfix that allows you to put a time delay between every single message that you send to a site. At that point, your concurrency is by definition 1. You're spacing the messages out 1 by 1. And if that's sufficiently fast for you, cool. You know, so if you're, you know, sending to Verizon's, you know, home Soho relay, and, you know, from your home server, and, you know, the volume you're sending is light but uneven, you can smooth it out by producing these rate delays.
You may have noticed that we're not talking about a feature that is really beloved only for people who are really physical, old end user kind of service. And there are people who are having that kind of service, but they can only send 1 email every day. The challenge here for me is as a billion service NCIA in fact extend the spectrum, how broad the spectrum can be spent. Without needing lots of exotic configurations. So to a large extent, people figure things out, but when it gets really nasty, like people having hard rate limits or people having hard concurrency limits, then there's no way that Postfix can figure those things out and then it needs some help. So there are a few things that it needs help.
Right. So there
is to spend a very large spectrum for laptops to big multi-conceptual processes.
But these rate limits are used by all of the big email
but a lot of ISP relay hosts that collect mail from what they expect to be home PCs using MUAs.
It's not
right. Are rate limiting their users because they want to limit the amount of damage that a virus outbreak on one machine can do before they clean it up. And so by rate limiting the output of each and every machine, they reduce the amount of abuse disk crap they have to deal with when that one machine goes wild. And they apply this policy to everybody.
You know, Google throws up a captcha.
Right. Stuff like that. Right. So basically, if that's the environment you live in and you can only afford a connection, you know, the DSL line, the cheap one that comes with your ISP, and you have to send mail to their relay host, because of course you're on the PBL anyway, so you can't send mail to anybody else, and their relay host will rate limit you, you're basically, you're a third-class citizen in the SMTP world. And you get third-class service, And you might have to adjust to it with these rate delay features. They're in 2.5. There's a Soho README file that describes the various things that you have to, all the hoops you have to jump through. The scheduler README file describes this kind of stuff with all these numbers.
What percentage of spam overall, though, are those clients responsible for?
Probably? Oh, the vast majority of spam,
exactly.
Yes. but any one of them is rate limited. But the vast majority of spam comes from them.
Now you're talking about the last point, not the second point.
Sorry.
Use negative feedback point, that's something else you're talking about.
The negative feedback is Yahoo's of this world when you're running a mailing list on a site that's too small to bother getting on the Yahoo's whitelist. Right? You're not tall enough for them to bother with you, or you think you're not tall enough, and your volume is kind of sort of medium, so you want to not bother and just fly under the radar, and you think you can do it, but you don't want them to refuse all your mail. You try and tune it to just, you know, not bug them too much so they'll block you. I think it's a stupid game to play, but maybe they know better than I do, and it actually makes sense to do it this way rather than go through the bureaucracy of getting on Yahoo's whitelist. I don't know. But it's really for people who operate small-time lists of various sorts. Small businesses that send mail to their clients, whatever, they want to tune for this kind of environment. They're willing for the mail to take a long time. They're not worried about latency. They just want it to get there. They want it to be refused and get blacklisted and have no mail flow. So I'd rather it go slowly. And it's okay for them to have a...
Would be good
default. Default. I would disagree. I mean, if people get POSIX put it through a benchmark and write one of the shittiest MTA ever, you know. Delivers, you know, one message every 10 minutes, you know, fuck that, you know, right? It's just not, you know, no, I mean, it should work fast by default. It's not really a Soho MTA. If you want a Soho MTA, you know, there are these things, mini send mail or something, that don't even have a queue, right? They just SMTP sent to a fixed host, and you can deploy that stuff. I mean, if they wanted to, POSIX is way too heavyweight for something that's that simple, that sends all mail to one destination at a fixed rate. I mean, it's sort of an abuse, really. The only reason they're doing it with POSIX is probably it comes in the Linux distribution and they've heard about this POSIX thing. If they thought more wisely, there's probably a better way of doing this that just has a simple process, SMTP sender, right, mini SMTP or whatever, just wakes up every 5 minutes and sends something, you know. Cron job, you know, send one message, go to sleep. Right? I mean, why POSIX, really? But we do accommodate them.
Use the LPR queue.
Yeah, exactly, you're right. Just pull messages out of the line printer. So that's the end of the talk. Wow, it took a long time. It's unlikely we'll talk about other topics at this point, but follow-up questions.